Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, March 29th, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on the drought in the Southwest, then another top article on the Navajo Council and voter IDs, then we'll move on to Valley and State news, and then conclude the first hour with articles from USA Today that are in national and world news. So our feature front page article for today is entitled Dry Land. The subtitle is Some Scientists Believe the Southwest is Experiencing Aridification, a Permanent Shift to a Drier Climate, Not Just a Prolonged Drought. This is by Haley Evans. For thousands of years, drought in Arizona has followed a familiar arc. Dry years stacked up, water supply shrunk, and snowpack lacked its usual depth. Then, eventually, the pattern broke with a run of snowy winters, dramatic monsoons, and a sense that balance had been restored in an ecosystem that had adapted for survival. This cyclical pattern is baked into life in the Southwest. Drought is painful, but temporary, until it's not. Arizona has recorded about 11 inches of rain statewide, less in Phoenix, more in the high country, every year since the 1990s, an inch below the long-term average and enough to declare a drought. As the state enters the 32nd year of drought, the end should be near. Statistically, droughts in the desert tend to last about 35 years. Previous major droughts occurred in the 1920s and 30s during the Dust Bowl era and again in the 1950s. But scientists fear this pattern no longer holds. What looks like prolonged drought may actually be something more permanent in the Southwest, a shift toward a drier baseline driven by rising temperatures. Even when rain and snow return, the landscape holds less water than it once did. Scientists have a term for this larger shift, aridification. Unlike drought, which is defined by below-average precipitation over months to decades, aridification describes a long-term transformation of the climate system itself. Warming temperatures increase evaporation from soils, plants, and snowpack, meaning the same amount of precipitation now produces less usable water. Trees experience drought stress. Rivers produce less water. Forests grow unhealthy and vulnerable to wildfire. Native species suffer as the landscape shifts. Snowpack shrinks. And the past stops working as an indicator of the future. The result is a region where water stress lingers and the ecosystem transforms, even in years that would once have brought relief. Droughts, by definition, have beginnings and ends, said Michael Crimmins, a climatologist at the University of Arizona. Aridification is a systematic shift that doesn't necessarily have an end to it. That distinction is shaping how scientists, water managers, and ecologists think about Arizona's future and why the current drought may not end in the way many expect. When temperatures rise, there's less runoff to go around. Arizona's climate has always been volatile, with alternating dry and wet periods that can span decades. Tree ring records stretch back thousands of years, showing cycles of wet decades punctuated by severe long-term drought. Some of those historical dry periods rival or even exceed today's drought in terms of below-average precipitation. Even though the Southwest may be getting the same amount of rain as droughts in the past, average temperatures have risen steadily since the late 1800s as greenhouse gases trap more heat in the atmosphere. The warming isn't just the extremes we see in the headlines, with daily highs pushing past 115 degrees in Phoenix. The shift is quieter than that in the transitional months. Spring in Arizona warms up earlier, and the heat lingers well into the fall. Fall 2024 was Phoenix's hottest fall on record, with 21 consecutive days of daily record highs and multiple 110-degree days well into the season. This has repercussions for how water traditionally moves through the atmosphere, the soils, and in waterways throughout the year. As temperatures rise, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor, increasing evaporative demand. That means a warmer atmosphere pulls more moisture from soils, vegetation, and snowpack. Snow melts earlier, soils dry out faster, and plants lose water more quickly. In practical terms, precipitation totals alone no longer tell the water story in the Southwest. There could be years with near normal rainfall on paper, but with rising temperatures, it may not be as moist on the ground. Detecting this shift isn't easy in a place that's already dry. Variability is normal, but teasing out evidence of how this is happening and how quickly has been tricky. "The climate down here is noisy," Crimmin said. "A signal can be buried in that noise, but aridification is definitely occurring, and it's more long-term. It doesn't have this hard edge to it where you go from things are fine to an abrupt change to a different system, because the system is already pretty arid." But the climatological noise has fueled debate over whether the Southwest is simply locked in another multi-decade drought or if a fundamental shift is happening. Researchers say multiple independent lines of evidence now point in the same direction. Warming is changing the baseline. Tree rings record the difference between dry and warmer dry conditions. Some of the clearest evidence comes not from the desert floor, but from Arizona's forests in tree ring records that go back centuries. Tree ring scientists, or dendrochronologists, can glimpse into past droughts and compare them to today's dry spells. Trees act as natural climate archives, preserving year-by-year records of how they respond to environmental conditions, like temperature and precipitation. Trees grow a wider ring during favorable wet years. Narrow rings signal drought stress. By analyzing trees across the region, researchers can compare how forests responded to past droughts under cooler conditions versus today's warmer climate. The results are striking. The big difference between the droughts we're seeing now compared to the droughts we saw in the 1900s, these are warmer droughts, said Margaret Evans, a dendrochronologist at the University of Arizona's Laboratory of Tree Ring Research. Collaborating with the Navajo Forestry Department, a team from Evans' lab took samples of trees from the Defiance Plateau, the Chaska Mountains, and the Lukachukai Mountains, all in northeastern Arizona, to study drought's impact on trees. Historically, trees sitting at higher levels do better than those at lower elevations during drought. Higher elevations tend to have lower temperatures and more snowpack, which benefits trees in the mountains. What the data showed us is that in the last 30 years, when you have these unusually warm spring temperatures, basically all of the trees are doing badly, she said. Climate change is like a rising tide of warming, and that rising tide is now reaching the highest elevation point. Evans calls this a synchronizing drought, where all trees across all forest types, regardless of topographic location or slope, are experiencing similar levels of drought stress and putting on thinner rings. Trees across the state are struggling to thrive in warmer temperatures, even with similar amounts of precipitation. If you get the same amount of snow, but it melts faster in the 2002 drought compared to a 1930s drought, then the trees in the 1930s with the same amount of precipitation is doing much better, Evans said. The proof is in the rings. Evans pulled tree ring samples from the early 2000s, which showed a thin ring during the 2002 drought compared to wetter years. Compared to droughts in the 1900s with similar rainfall but cooler temperatures, rings in the 2000s were thinner. This combination doesn't just slow growth. It can push trees past survival thresholds, which can cascade across the ecosystem. The trees are an indicator of what's happening to the whole system, Evans said. If a tree isn't growing well, that's an indication there is a drought. Snow melts earlier, which means the fuels dry out earlier and you have a longer fire season. This also increases trees' vulnerability to insect outbreaks and limits their ability to sequester carbon. Trees absorb carbon from the atmosphere, offsetting the impacts of climate change, a process known as carbon sequestration. When trees die, that stored carbon is released back into the atmosphere. That limits the capacity of one of Earth's biggest carbon sinks and amplifies warming. Less water reaching the rivers. This warmer but not necessarily drier shift that is reshaping forests is also altering how water moves through the Southwest river systems, including those that supply millions of people in central Arizona. On the Colorado River, higher temperatures are reducing runoff efficiency in ways that are difficult to reverse. Warmer conditions reduce runoff efficiency even in years with decent snowpack. More precipitation falls as rain instead of snow, reducing the slow release runoff that mountain snowpack once provided. The Southwest has seen its lowest January snow cover on record in 2026, even though most regions saw average to above average precipitation through the fall and early winter. But warmer temperatures meant it hit the ground as rain rather than snow. NASA's Terra satellite provided insight into the lackluster snowpack across the West on January 15th. It found snow covered 142,700 square miles of the West, the lowest coverage on record dating back to 2001. While there is still time left in the snow season for snow to accumulate, this shows how temperatures are a primary driver, not just the amount of precipitation that falls. At the same time, soils dry out faster and absorb more water before runoff can even begin. When soils are already dry, it's like a sponge that needs to fill up first, said Nolly Templeton, a senior policy analyst with Central Arizona Project's Colorado River programs. That water has to go somewhere before it ever reaches the river. Over time, those losses compound. Even when winters deliver near average snowpack, less water ultimately reaches Lake Powell and Lake Mead. Scientists and water managers say the temperature, not just precipitation, is now one of the dominant forces shaping how much water the river can reliably produce. That dynamic is a central reason researchers describe the basin as experiencing aridification rather than a temporary drought. Warming permanently handicaps the watershed, shrinking the payoff from wet years. The Salt and Verde River systems that supply much of Metro Phoenix are also affected by rising temperatures, but their response to aridification looks different. At Salt River Project, climate scientists say it can be difficult to neatly separate drought from aridification. Instead, long-term planning assumes deeper droughts layered on top of natural variability. Hotter conditions reduce stream flow in the Salt and Verde rivers, according to Bo Svoma, SRP climate scientist and senior meteorologist, but not as sharply as in the Colorado River basin. It's fundamentally because even before climate change, we receive plenty of our stream flow in the winter with rainfall and winter snowmelt, Svoma said. We weren't completely snow-dominated. Svoma also highlights the potential for extreme wet years even with a warmer atmosphere. Climate projections suggest that when wet winters occur, they may be even wetter, increasing the swing between drought and deluge. The Salt and Verde Reservoir system is designed to capitalize on those wet years. After several years of drought, it was able to refill in 2023 and 2024 following a single exceptionally wet winter, although SRP's storage capacity is smaller than the Colorado River. That contrast highlights a core reality of aridification in the Southwest. Not all river systems respond the same way. While local watersheds may still recover after wet years, the Colorado River has less room to rebound. But CAP is planning for deeper shortages, conserving water during wet periods, expanding reuse and storage, and rethinking how much water the river can reliably deliver over the long term. The goal, Templeton said, is not to wait out the drought, but to manage the river in a way that remains viable in a warmer, more arid future. What drying out looks like in the desert. In the Sonoran Desert, aridification doesn't always show up as less rain on paper, but when the rain falls and how plants are able to use it. Life in the desert is built around timing. Many native plants evolved to take advantage of frequent, modest rain events spread across the monsoon season. But those rhythms are starting to break. We see fewer rain events, but more rain per event, said Elise Gornish, director of the Desert Laboratory at Tumamoc Hill at the University of Arizona. The same amount of rain can't be used in the same way. When rain arrives all at once, desert soils often can't absorb it. Water runs off quickly, carrying seeds and topsoil with it. Plants germinate after heavy storms, only to die when the next rain doesn't come for weeks. Temperature also disrupts the biological cues plants depend on to survive. The warmer it is, the faster plants lose moisture from the soil surface, and some desert species require a certain number of cold days to trigger germination. As winter warms, those cues become less reliable. Plants sprout at the wrong time, creating mismatches with pollinators and other species that haven't shifted in sync. That creates cascading effects, Gornish said. If flowers bloom when pollinators aren't there, you get fewer seeds. Then you get fewer plants. Then you get fewer animals. Over the long term, aridification favors fast-growing, non-native species over slow-growing natives adapted to historic rainfall patterns. Invasive grasses fill the gaps, increasing fire risk and reducing biodiversity. Native trees and saguaros respond to this shift slowly, sometimes taking decades to show stress. But long-term monitoring suggests even these iconic species may struggle to persist in a warmer and drier climate. I think it's going to turn into monocultures, which is really too bad because the Sonoran Desert is the most diverse desert on the planet, Gorish said. There could be a point where only a few things can live here. They're all going to be non-native, these bunch grasses that catch on fire really quickly, so they will become grasslands. But this shift doesn't leave people powerless, Gornish said, that even small pockets of plant habitat can make a measurable difference in how desert ecosystems cope with heat and drought. Planting native species in urban and suburban places can help stabilize soils, retain moisture, and support pollinators. And native plants can survive more easily when watered and cared for in backyards and community spaces. Most people wonder what they can do to help, but there are a lot of studies that have shown yards, gardens, and patios are really critical habitat for both plants and pollinators, Gornish said. We should plant things that are needed and more likely to survive aridification, and we're doing the research to figure that out. Living with a new normal. Aridification doesn't announce itself with a single dry year or an empty reservoir. It shows up gradually, in tree rings, drier soils, rivers that don't rebound the way they used to, and plants blooming out of sync. None of this means Arizona is running out of water overnight, or that the desert is doomed to disappear. The shift is harder to see because it unfolds slowly, layered on top of a climate that has always swung between extremes. But scientists say understanding and planning for that change matters. It reframes drought not as a temporary crisis, but as a long-term condition that touches everything from forests and deserts to water supplies and daily life in Arizona. Aridification doesn't eliminate uncertainty, it sharpens it. And scientists are planning not for the climate they remember, but for the one they see coming. And that article was entitled Dry Land. That was by Haley Evans. Now, our next top story from today's Republic is entitled Navajo Council Mulls Voter ID Opposition. The subtitle is Concern That Bill Could Disenfranchise Members. This is by Alyssa DePicenti. Amid uncertainty over whether Congress will pass the SAVE Act, a sweeping elections reform package pushed by President Donald Trump, the Navajo Nation Council has introduced a resolution opposing the measure, raising concerns that the bill would disenfranchise voters. The resolution will be considered by the Nabikiati Committee. It would put the council on record formally opposing H.R. 7296, the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility SAVE Act, and affirm the Navajo Nation's commitment to protecting voting rights by rejecting federal measures seen as unnecessary and discriminatory barriers to participation. The federal elections bill, passed by the U.S. House in February, would require voters to provide documentary proof of citizenship when registering and a photo ID when casting a ballot. Similar bills with proof of citizenship requirements passed the House in 2024 and 2025, but stalled in the Senate. Although similar in many ways, the current bill includes provisions addressing in-person and mail-in voting and could disproportionately impact women who have changed their last names after marriage, as their birth certificates or passports often do not reflect their married name. Those changes could negatively impact Native voters, tribal leaders say. It's disenfranchising, again, our vote, said Navajo Nation Speaker Kristalyn Curley. Also, especially for our elders, looking at how many of our people already struggle with the current voting system and then adding an additional barrier. To me, it's not right. The Native American Rights Fund has also said that all forms of the SAVE Act are harmful to Native voters. Among the concerns, the proposed voter restrictions would effectively eliminate popular methods of voter registration, including online and mail registration, as well as voter registration drives. Americans would be required to physically travel to their designated election office during weekday business hours to present their documentation to an election official. American Indian, Native Hawaiian, and Alaska Native citizens living in rural and remote areas travel further to their election offices than the average American. In some areas of the country, people living in tribal communities would have to travel over 100 miles or even get on an airplane in order to reach their designated election office. How new rules could hurt elders trying to vote. Advocates say an increase in ICE detainments and the potential for racial profiling over the past year have heightened the need for indigenous individuals from federally recognized tribes to obtain and carry necessary documentation, such as a certificate of Indian blood or tribal ID. Curley noted that retrieving these documents has been challenging, an example of how difficult it will be for voters to retrieve additional documents when registering to vote. The challenges already exist because there are only a limited number of places to access vital records, said Curley. For example, if you are living in Phoenix, Denver, or elsewhere in Arizona, you may have to travel to obtain these documents, which requires additional time and resources. This becomes even more difficult for individuals who do not have reliable transportation or access to telecommunication services, as they must rely on their own limited resources. Curley said about 63% of voters on tribal lands in Apache and Navajo counties vote by mail. She added that elderly members of the Navajo Nation face greater challenges due to medical conditions, limited mobility, and lack of reliable transportation, making it especially difficult to obtain required documents. While these issues are already ongoing, adding additional federal regulations could further complicate access, said Curley. Rather than improving the situation, it may create more barriers for people trying to obtain essential records. Many of our elders, which is our biggest population that come out to vote, are born at home or in remote areas. She added that delays and inconsistencies in documentation are common challenges for elderly voters, but they do try to fix these issues. Usually, many of the elders that try to get documentation, their names are different or spelled different, or they would have a Navajo name and then translated into English, or different birth dates or different birth locations, said Curley. So many of them are fixing those types of inconsistencies. The Native American Rights Fund said the SAVE Act claims that tribal members will be able to use the tribal ID to register. However, the bill requires tribal IDs to include the holder's place of birth, which they typically do not. As a result, American Indian and Alaska Native voters would need additional documents, such as a certified birth certificate, hospital record, or adoption decree to register, which can be costly and difficult to obtain or replace. Native voters have long fought for voting rights. Although Congress passed the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924, granting U.S. citizenship to Native Americans born in the United States, many states continued for decades to block full participation in elections through discriminatory laws and practices. Native voters faced barriers such as residency challenges, literacy tests, limited access to registration, intimidation, and inconsistent election administration. Even years later, Navajo voting rights were still contested. For example, after the 1960 New Mexico Lieutenant Governor election, a legal challenge sought to invalidate votes cast by Navajo residents on reservations. The New Mexico Supreme Court rejected the claim, affirming their rights, while highlighting that citizenship alone did not guarantee equal access to voting. When it gets real close to elections, we see bills like this in some shape or form, said Curley. May not be exactly the same, but it's always kind of like a different tactic to disenfranchise our votes. The most recent problem involving Navajo votes was during the 2024 general elections. On election day, voters across Apache County, which has the most designated Indian reservation land of any county in the United States, faced significant challenges as voting machines malfunctioned and provisional ballots quickly ran out. As a result, those waiting in line often endured delays of up to 3 hours. Some voters ultimately left without casting their votes. In February, the Navajo Nation wrote to the Apache County Board of Supervisors in support of using voting centers instead of precinct-based polling places, and urged the board to approve the change. Voting centers will enable voters to choose from any open location rather than limit a voter to a single assigned location, stated the letter. Most Navajo voters drive a very long distance to cast their votes on election day, and if they drive to the wrong precinct, a frequent and easy mistake to make on the Navajo Nation, they may not have time, transportation, or fuel funds to then drive another long way to get to their sole precinct polling place. For Indigenous people, the right to vote carries particular importance because federal, state, and local elections directly affect matters central to tribal survival and self-determination, including Indian health care, education, housing, water rights, infrastructure, public safety, sacred sites, environmental protection, and the federal trust responsibility. Voting is one of the principal means by which Navajo citizens influence the laws, policies, budgets, and public officials whose decisions affect tribal communities both on and off the reservation. and meaningful access to the ballot is inseparable from the Navajo Nation's sovereign interests and the ability of its people to protect their political, cultural, and economic future, stated the council's resolution. And that article is entitled, Navajo Council Mulls Voter ID Opposition. That was by Arlissa D. Bicenti. We're 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, March 29th, 2026. We're going to move to Valley and State News with this article entitled, Land Auction Could Advance Controversial Arizona Copper Mine. This is by Sarah Lapidus. An auction of state land wanted by a Canadian mining company in southern Arizona could advance a controversial copper mine, despite the objections of local officials and southern Arizona residents. The Arizona State Land Department announced an auction for 160 acres near Vail for $993,000. The auction is taking place in Tucson on April 29th. The state is auctioning the land at the request of Canadian mining company Hudbay Minerals Incorporated for its Copper World mine. The land is critical to the mining project because the mine is currently made up of two sections diagonal from each other. The company needs the 160 acres located in between them to access its northern portion. The auction is set to come after years of lawsuits and pushback from Pima County and local residents whose properties are next to the mine. Among those residents is Kathy McGrath, whose home is located 374 feet from the northern portion of the land adjacent to the parcel up for auction. Plans call for that northern portion to store mining byproduct that could contain heavy metals like arsenic, lead, and cadmium, known as tailings. McGrath said she fears the tailings will contaminate the air and water in her area. It's going to take time to notice it, and all the current politicians will be out of the way by then, by the time we're all sick, she said. Copper World is a proposed copper mine being developed by Hudbay Minerals. The company anticipates Copper World will be the third largest producer in the U.S. of domestic copper cathode, a highly pure form of copper. The project will be a massive mining complex on 4,500 acres in the Santa Rita Mountains that would include up to five open pit mines and waste rock and tailing storage facilities. The company said the project will be developed in two phases. The first phase would require state and local permits for a 20-year mining project and cost $1.7 billion to develop. The company said the second phase will extend the mine's life, but did not add any details. The Arizona Department of Environmental Quality issued an air quality permit and an aquifer protection permit, adding monitoring and compliance requests following public comment, according to the company's website. The company did not respond to a request for comment. The mining company owns a sliver of land sandwiched between the Santa Rita Experimental Range to the west, part of the University of Arizona's Arizona Experiment Station system, and U.S. Forest Service land to the east. The northern section of the land sits next to Corona de Tucson residential area. McGrath and her neighbors, who have formed the group No Copper World, are worried about the effect of toxic minerals in the tailings blown into the air by strong winds. They also feared that the mine's explosions would blow plumes into the sky, coating the air and surrounding vegetation with harmful particles and spores. Anti-mine advocates say the 160 acres of state land being auctioned is a key step in moving Copper World forward. Without access to the plot of land being auctioned, or a right-of-way across the Santa Rita Experimental Range, the mine can't access two sites to store tailings, said John Doherty, the executive director of Save the Scenic Santa Ritas. I'm not saying that they couldn't get it, Doherty said about access to the northern parcel, but it would be another big fight that we would definitely oppose. And so that land right now to the north is stranded to them. Save the Scenic Santa Rita's Association is the primary group against the mine's land. The group on March 6th called on the Arizona Commissioner of Lands to cancel the auction. Pima County highlighted its support of the group's protest in a March 9th letter to Governor Katie Hobbs, saying the sale of the 160 acres of land would give the mine access to an additional 480 acres of land it owns to the north. If they successfully access those 480 acres, the school and homes would be closer to the tailings than any small buffer that HUDBAY is saying the 160-acre parcel would provide without any assurances, the county said. The county's letter came after Hobbs refused to block the sale, according to the Arizona Daily Star, saying the mine was inevitable with or without the state's intervention. Hobbs' office declined to comment for the story. Doherty called the governor's comments a slap in the face. Doherty said it is too early to auction the property, pointing to HUDBAY's 2023 pre-feasibility study. The study said that Northern Tailings Facility is considered optional at this time. The storage site also wouldn't be needed for over a decade. This location would not be utilized for tailings storage until year 15 of operations. HUDBAY believes that a preferable alternative location for tailings storage can be secured by that time, the study said. McGrath told the Arizona Republic she still hopes the governor postpones the auction until the mine's final feasibility study or plan is published. Why don't we wait until we see what's in their final plan before we give them the land that's going to condemn us? She asked. Pima County said in its letter to Hobbs it disagrees with the governor's assertion the mine is inevitable and that the mine will buffer the residential areas. Pima County Administrator Jan Lesher said in the letter the mine has not yet been sanctioned by HUDBAY's board and their new partner, Mitsubishi. Lesher said per Canadian security regulations, it can only be sanctioned after review of a yet-to-be-completed feasibility study. She also said there is no assurance of a buffer to protect residential areas from the tailings storage site if HUDBAY gains access to the parcel. If they successfully access those 480 acres, the school and homes would be closer to the tailings than any small buffer that HUDBAY is saying the 160-acre parcel would provide without any assurance, Lesher wrote. The county noted in its letter to the governor that it's not against mining and pointed to its support of other mining projects. And that article is entitled, Land Auction Could Advance Controversial Arizona Copper Mine. That was by Sarah Lapidus. Our next article is entitled, EPA Says It Won't Penalize Metro Phoenix for Ozone Imports Beyond State's Control. This is by Sarah Henry. Metro Phoenix has the fourth worst ozone levels in the country, but the federal government has excused the region from meeting stricter air quality standards, saying much of the pollution is beyond the state's control. The Environmental Protection Agency said on March 23rd, it would not reclassify the Phoenix Mesa area, which includes Maricopa and parts of Gila and Pinal counties, as a serious non-attainment zone for ozone, meaning the area would not be subject to more severe rules. For now, it will remain a moderate non-attainment zone. For decades, the Phoenix area has struggled to meet federal air quality standards for ozone under the Clean Air Act. Surrounded by mountains, the region is like a big soup bowl, ozone pools together, hanging over the valley in a haze. But since 2023, local municipalities have argued that the majority of ozone plaguing the cities is not their fault. Despite reducing local ozone-forming emissions, levels continued to rise, officials said. Instead, they blamed pollution blowing downwind from other states and traveling across the border from Mexico and as far away as Asia. Last March, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin visited Phoenix to talk with officials about the classification. Many shared concerns that a serious non-attainment label would put undue regulatory pressure on industries in the Valley and squander potential economic opportunity. A month later, the agency hit pause on the impending redesignation and rescinded a federal rule that made it unnecessarily difficult for states like Arizona and Utah to show that foreign emissions were polluting their air. Now, Zeldin's EPA has granted their wish. Under a provision in the Clean Air Act, regions that are out of compliance will not face more stringent designations if local governments can prove the area would have achieved standards without the interference of international emissions. Local officials are celebrating the win, but environmental and public health advocates worry it's part of a broader effort to chip away at a cornerstone environmental policy. Ground-level ozone forms when sunlight and heat supercharge reactions between two kinds of air pollutants, volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides. Cars, airplanes, power plants, factories, even paint and cleaning products emit VOCs and NOx. From peak levels in the 1980s and 90s, ozone has been on an overall decline in the Valley. Since the Clean Air Act, there have been significant improvements in our ozone emissions, said Melissa Ramos, a clean air advocacy manager for the American Lung Association. In 2015, the EPA passed stricter ozone standards. Around the same time, ozone levels in the Phoenix Mesa area slowly started to rise again. Regional and EPA modeling show that about 80% of the ozone is uncontrollable, meaning it's from natural sources like wildfire and from across-the-border pollution. The remaining 20% is local and human-made. In 2023, after being bumped up from marginal to moderate non-attainment, local officials missed a deadline to submit plans to the EPA outlining how they would come into compliance by cutting pollution. They couldn't show that reducing emissions locally would meaningfully reduce ozone. We were at this difficult point where we were trying to solve 100% of the problem, but were limited to only 20% of the solution, said Matthew Poppin, the Director of Environmental Planning at the Maricopa Association of Governments, which leads air quality planning for the region. We were stuck. We didn't have a way to move forward with local reductions that would get us to meet the standard. But environmentalists and public health advocates are skeptical that the counties have done all they can. Ryan Mayer, a staff attorney for the Center of Biological Diversity, said the March 23rd EPA decision is a triple threat: a worsening of air quality, a lessening of regulation and industry benefiting at the expense of public health. This is the first time the EPA has used this provision of the Clean Air Act since Zeldin rescinded the federal rule last April, but it might not be the last. Utah is caught in a similar situation. The Northern Wasatch Front, which includes Salt Lake City, has failed to meet ozone standards for decades. Last March, the EPA agreed to reconsider its determination that the area failed to attain the air quality standards in a timely manner, which would result in a reclassification from moderate to serious non-attainment. Utah's Department of Environmental Quality has said that at least 20% of the West ozone has traveled over from Asia. This is all part of a general trend undermining Clean Air Act requirements, Mayer said. At the end of January, the EPA announced plans to reconsider its Good Neighbor Plan, which aimed to curb traveling pollution between neighboring states like Arizona, New Mexico, and Nevada. And that article is entitled, EPA Says It Won't Penalize Metro Phoenix for Ozone Imports Beyond States' Control. That was by Sarah Henry. We're going to turn now to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We've got two front page articles. The first is on anti-Trump rallies. The second is on the war in the Middle East. Our first article is entitled, Anti-Trump Rallies Held in Thousands of Cities. The subtitle is, No King's Protests Decry President's Policies, War. This is by Tim Reed and Brad Brooks. Demonstrators decrying President Donald Trump's aggressive deportation efforts, war in Iran, and other policies took to city streets across the country on March 28th in the third round of No King's rallies. More than 3,200 events were planned in all 50 states. The two previous No King's events attracted millions of participants. In Minnesota, a flashpoint in Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration, a massive rally was held outside the state capitol building in St. Paul. Many in the crowd there held aloft posters bearing photos of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, whom immigration officers fatally shot in Minneapolis this year. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, the Democratic vice presidential nominee in 2024, told the crowd that their resistance to Trump and his policies makes them the heart and soul of everything good about the U.S. "They call us radicals," Walz said. "You're damn right we've been radicalized. Radicalized by compassion, radicalized by decency, radicalized by due process, radicalized by democracy, and radicalized to do all we can to oppose authoritarianism." Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, a Trump critic who sought the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016 and 2020, was another speaker at the event in Minnesota. Musician Bruce Springsteen also appeared and performed his song "Streets of Minneapolis," a ballad that blasts Trump's immigration crackdown and laments the deaths of Good and Preddy. "We will not allow this country to descend into authoritarianism or oligarchy in America," said Sanders, an independent. "We, the people, will rule." Other large rallies took place in New York, Dallas, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and Washington. But two-thirds of the events were happening outside major cities, a nearly 40% jump for smaller communities from the movement's first mobilization last June, organizers said. In New York, a crowd that police estimated at tens of thousands stretched more than 10 blocks in Midtown Manhattan. Actor Robert De Niro, one of the organizers, said that no president before Trump has posed such an existential threat to our freedoms and security. Holly Bemis, 44, said she and other New York rally attendees were acting in the same spirit as her ancestors who fought in the American Revolution. "We fought against having kings, and we fought for freedom," she said. "We're just doing it again." On the National Mall in Washington, the crowd chanted pro-democracy slogans and held anti-Trump signs. Outside one assisted living center in Chevy Chase, Maryland, a group of elderly people in wheelchairs held signs encouraging passing cars to resist tyranny, honk if you want democracy, and dump Trump. Thousands attended a Dallas event that had clashes between No King's demonstrators and counter-protest groups, including one led by Enrique Tarrio, the former leader of the far-right organization the Proud Boys. Minor scuffles erupted when counter-protesters blocked the streets. Dallas police eventually made several arrests. "Trump's policies have galvanized the opposition," said Dallas protester Chris Brendel. "One thing I'll give Trump credit for is mobilizing the dissenters. I can't stand by and be silent anymore simply because of my boys and their friends and the future," Brendel said. Trump's approval rating has fallen to 36%, its lowest point since his return to the White House, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll. A spokesperson for the National Republican Congressional Committee criticized Democratic politicians and candidates for supporting the rallies. "These hate America rallies are where the far left's most violent, deranged fantasies get a microphone and House Democrats get their marching orders," spokesperson Mike Marinella said in a statement. With midterm elections later this year, organizers say they have seen a surge in the number of people organizing anti-Trump events and registering to participate in deeply Republican states like Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and Utah. Competitive suburban areas that have helped decide national elections are seeing huge increases in interest, said Lee Greenberg, co-founder of Indivisible, the group that started the No Kings movement last year and led planning of the March 28th events. She cited examples in Pennsylvania's Bucks and Delaware counties, East Cobb and Forsyth in Georgia, and Scottsdale and Chandler in Arizona. The No Kings movement, launched last year on Trump's birthday, June 14th, drew an estimated 4 million to 6 million people across roughly 2,100 sites nationwide. The second mobilization in October involved an estimated 7 million participants in more than 2,700 cities, according to a crowdsourcing analysis published by prominent data journalist G. Elliott Morris. The March 28th events come amid what organizers said was a call to action against the bombardment of Iran by the United States and Israel. And that article is entitled, Anti-Trump Rallies Held in Thousands of Cities. That was by Tim Reed and Brad Brooks. Our second front-page article from USA Today is entitled, Yemen's Houthis Enter Conflict. The subtitle is, Group Targets Israel as U.S. Marines Arrive in Region. This is by Mena Ala El-Din, Nayera Abdallah, and Humaira Pamuk. The risk of an expanded Iran war grew on March 28th as Yemen's Iran-aligned Houthis launched their first attacks on Israel since the start of the conflict, even as additional U.S. forces reached the Middle East. Speaking before the strike, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the United States expected to conclude military operations within weeks, although a new deployment of U.S. Marines started arriving in the region. The Houthis said they would continue their operations until the aggression on all fronts ended. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian spoke to Pakistan's Prime Minister Shahbaz Sharif, whose government hosts a meeting with the Turkish and Saudi foreign ministers on March 29th to seek to ease regional tensions. But there is no sign of an immediate diplomatic breakthrough, and the war, launched in the U.S. and Israeli strikes on Iran on February 28th, has spread across the Middle East, killing thousands and hitting the world economy with the biggest ever disruption to global energy supplies. On March 28th, Israel said it had carried out a wave of attacks on Tehran, targeting what the military said were infrastructure sites belonging to Iran's government. It also hit targets in Lebanon, where it has resumed its war against Iran-backed Hezbollah, killing three Lebanese journalists in a strike on a media vehicle, Lebanon's Al-Manar TV reported, as well as a Lebanese soldier. A follow-up strike on rescue workers sent to assist them also caused fatalities. Israel's military said it targeted one of the journalists, whom it called a terrorist, accusing him of being part of a Hezbollah intelligence unit and saying he reported Israeli soldiers' locations. Iran kept up attacks on Israel and several Gulf states after hitting a base in Saudi Arabia on March 27th and wounding 12 U.S. military personnel, two of them seriously, in one of the most serious breaches of U.S. air defenses so far. Washington has dispatched two contingents of thousands of Marines to the Middle East, the first of which arrived on March 27th on an amphibious assault ship, the U.S. military said on March 28th. The United States could achieve its aims without ground troops, Rubio said on March 27th, but acknowledged it was deploying some to the region so President Donald Trump would have maximum flexibility to adjust strategy as needed. The Pentagon is also expected to deploy thousands of soldiers from its 82nd Airborne Division. Houthis can strike targets far from Yemen. Israel, which regularly faced missile attacks from the Houthis before the war, confirmed a missile had been fired at it from Yemen. There were no reports of casualties or damage. The attack pointed to a potential new threat to global shipping, already hit by the effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the conduit for about a fifth of global oil and liquefied natural gas supplies. Houthi military spokesperson Yahya Sari later said the group carried out a second attack on Israel in less than 24 hours, using missiles and drones, and vowed to continue military operations in the coming days. The Houthis have shown an ability to strike targets far from Yemen and disrupt shipping lanes around the Arabian Peninsula and the Red Sea, as they did in support of Hamas in the Gaza War. On March 27th, they said they were prepared to act if what they called an escalation against Iran and the axis of resistance continued in the war. One target for the Houthis could be the Bab al-Mandab Strait off the coast of Yemen, a choke point for sea traffic toward the Suez Canal. With midterm elections due in November, the increasingly unpopular war has weighed on Trump's Republican Party, and he has appeared eager to end it soon, while also threatening escalation. Demonstrators took to city streets across the United States on March 28th in anti-Trump rallies described by organizers as a call to action against the war on Iran. Financial markets have reacted with alarm to signs the war may drag on. The Brent crude oil benchmark is up more than 50% since the war began. More strikes while Trump speaks of negotiations. Trump has threatened to hit Iranian power stations and other energy infrastructure if Iran does not open the Strait of Hormuz. But he has extended a deadline he had imposed for this past week, giving Iran another 10 days to respond. Iranian threats to attack ships in the strait have kept most oil tankers from attempting the waterway. A few vessels have traversed the strait without issue, including ships under the flags of Pakistan and India, after Iranian assurances of safe passage. Iran has agreed to allow an additional 20 Pakistani-flagged vessels to pass through the strait, with two ships permitted to transit daily, said Pakistan's Foreign Minister Ishaq Dar. Israel has targeted Iran's nuclear infrastructure, and the head of Russia's state nuclear corporation, Rosatom, which has evacuated staff from the Bushehr nuclear power plant on the Gulf Coast, said the attacks threaten nuclear safety. Pezeshkian said Iran would retaliate strongly if our infrastructure or economic centers are targeted. And that is all the time that we have for this article entitled Yemen's Houthis Enter Conflict. That was by Mena Ala Eldin, Nayera Abdallah, and Humaira Pamuk. And this concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, March 29th, 2026. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.